Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, liberty, and justice. Thank you. Okay. Have you had a chance to review the minutes from the previous meeting, May 3rd meeting?
And I'll make a motion that we approve the minutes.
Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? No? Okay. Thank you. Okay. So tonight we're going to go our annual presentation from SUNY Ulster. Ulster Community College will present their 2022-2023 budget overview to the committee. We will be having, I think we're going to be voting on that. When is the schedule on that again? It's a little bit.
July, at the July session, you'll be voting on the budget.
And we'll be at the college for that session, correct?
Yes, yeah. Sir.
Right, okay.
And just before you do that, I have a caller at 845-741-1997. Can I get your name?
Herb Litz.
Oh, hello, Herb.
How are you?
Very good. All right.
Okay, so with that, I'd like to introduce Jamie Capiano, who is the Vice President for Administrative Services at SUNY Ulster. Jamie,
thank you
very much for being here. Appreciate it. It's an exciting day out at the college with the announcement of the new president.
It is. Yes, we're very excited. Yep. To have SUNY approve that.
I just want to welcome you to the committee and go ahead and tell us what you got here. Thank you.
Perfect. And everyone can see the screen. 22-23 budget. Good. Okay. Perfect. Yep. It's the Zoom world we live in. Okay. So quick overview of a budget summary. The budget reflects zero layoffs. We always feel that that's very important as we go into our budget cycle. The budget does reflect savings that were achieved through retirement incentive. That was recently offered on the faculty side, and we did have a lot of interest in that retirement incentive. There's also a decrease in the adjunct staffing levels. Again, that's reflective of a decrease in overall enrollment, which I'll be diving into in a little bit. The budget does include several targeted initiatives to improve student retention. We are enhancing staffing levels within our Office for Accessibility Services. That department really services all of our students who have needs for disability, accommodations, anything of that need. And we are seeing a large increase in that since the pandemic. So this increase in the staffing levels there will better meet the needs of our students with disabilities. The budget also includes shared service initiatives. These are aimed at reducing operational costs while also trying to improve efficiencies. We have a shared service initiative with SUNY, that is our shared chief information officer, as well as server hosting. So as you know, when we do our capital projects, in the past, there has been requests for server upgrades. We've now put all of our servers with SUNY. They host our servers, and that creates a reduction in cost on campus. We are also continuing our shared service initiatives with the county. We've had great success with our purchasing shared service initiative with the county, and we work with the county on all of our bids and RFPs that are getting put out on the market. In terms of our total operational budget, the operational budget is $24.4 million. This does reflect a decrease of $2.9 million. That is mostly tied to the federal stimulus funds that have been reduced. We were required to use the federal stimulus funds for COVID-related expenses, so COVID-19 testing, social distancing measures, as well as classroom and equipment upgrades to provide remote classroom operations. We do have $1.4 million currently budgeted in federal stimulus funds into next year. That will provide mental health services for wraparound services that will be provided to students. We are also still required to continue our COVID-19 testing protocols, which will be continuing into next year. In terms of an overall revenue summary, the state did approve the floor funding model. We've spoken about that previously. Under this model, the state will provide the same level of state aid that was provided in the 21-22 year. While that represents, in essence, a maintenance of effort, it is based on a year when enrollment was reduced. So this model has not yet been established in permanent law. We are hopeful that given the model success with other community colleges, that the state legislature and the governor's office will ultimately include it in permanent law. Right now, it's just living in appropriation language, which can change annually. The budget reflects $6.4 million in county support through the maintenance of effort. And the budget does include a tuition increase of $100 per semester on a full-time basis and $10 per credit on a part-time basis. This modest increase will be offset largely by additional tuition assistance programs, such as the expansion of the TAP program for part-time students who are enrolled in 6 credits or more. And the expanded TAP program also does include workforce programming, which is the first time TAP has been offered in that avenue, which is really exciting for us at SUNY Ulster. And then in addition, the federal Pell Award amounts will be increasing in 22-23. And that support really provides financial support for our neediest students. It's also important to note that the Excelsior program's tuition rate will reboot in 22-23. That will eliminate what's called as the Excelsior gap. And that's the gap between the tuition rate approved through the program and the actual tuition rate charged by the college. So jumping in just a little bit more on the financial aid analysis that we've completed, it's important to know that 80% of students receive financial support through grants and scholarships. That includes TAP and Pell, which I just talked about, but also with the expansion of the part-time TAP, we do anticipate that number to increase in the next couple of years. Sorry, I'm still getting over a cold that I can't seem to get. In addition, SUNY Ulster's Foundation has been extremely supportive of our students, and the board recently announced a scholarship budget of $1 million, which is a huge increase from where we began back in 2015. So just taking a look at our tuition rate compared to other colleges and the SUNY average, the 22-23 tuition rate will be $5,080. This is below the statewide average of $5,115, and it's directly in line with our regional average. So it's always important for us to look at our regional area to see how we're comparing to those tuition rates. This tuition rate will remain the third lowest in the region behind Dutchess and Westchester County. And as of today, at least 12 other campuses are anticipating tuition rate increases for 22-23. So looking at enrollment numbers, so our budget does project a 16% decrease in overall enrollment for 22-23. This reduction reflects an ongoing shift from students enrolling on a part-time basis. We've seen this throughout the pandemic. Students are working, they need to enroll on a part-time basis. That shift has dramatically changed our enrollment climate. I will say, looking at overall, SUNY did project a decrease of 13% overall at community colleges. And our projection for 22-23 is conservative, but we did want to develop strong strategic initiatives to really increase enrollment going forward. And we always want to be conservative when we're estimating our enrollment numbers, especially given that shift to the part-time climate. So looking at enrollment by type, this is really important for us going into this budget cycle. So in 2019-20, about 37% of students were enrolled on a part-time basis, compared to 63% on a full-time basis. When we flash forward to today, that number is really 50-50. So although we receive less state aid on an FTE basis for a part-time student, our staff still provide the same level of services and support for all students enrolled at SUNY Ulster. So this is just a quick snapshot of your typical student experience through your every student experience. As I discussed, we do receive less state aid on the students coming in on a part-time basis. But as outlined on this slide, every student goes to admissions, financial aid, student accounts, public safety, health service, and the registrar's office. But a typical SUNY Ulster student will go to a lot more offices and receive a lot higher level of services on a per student basis than your typical student. For example, a student who was enrolled on a basis of 6 credits will only generate about $600 in state aid, while the same full-time student would be receiving about $3,000 in state aid. The floor model does try to achieve some equity within that, but the floor model is still based on a historical funding level, which included the per FTE amount. And then looking at some enrollment and recruitment initiatives, and I know Dr. Al is going to dive into this a lot more at the next meeting too, but the budget does reflect targeted enrollment and recruitment initiatives aimed at increasing enrollment and retention. So retention is a really key factor for us at SUNY Ulster. The students come in, they're engaged with us. We have to keep them engaged. We have to keep them coming back for that fall semester through summer session and then into the following fall. So we will be enhancing flexibility within our student service representatives. We found during the pandemic, students didn't want to meet with us between an 8:30 and a 4:30 schedule. They wanted flexibility. They wanted to be able to schedule remote sessions. They wanted to be able to do a pop-in visit, just ask a quick question. Our student service representatives were on that, and they're going to be having increased flexibility to still achieve those needs when students, those requests, sorry, when students need them. We will also be going back to recruitment efforts in person. So we found that enrollment and recruitment initiatives through Zoom just really weren't very successful. Students would, they would view it, they would come, they would listen, but they wouldn't really enroll. So we want to put a face to a name, and we want everybody to see us out in the community, back to those enrollment and recruitment initiatives, going back to the high schools, going back to the employers, so that they see us and that they connect, create that connection to enroll. And our enrollment team has also developed a new initiative called You're In. So this initiative, through this initiative, our enrollment team will be sending all Ulster County high school seniors an announcement saying that they've been accepted to SUNY Ulster. This will outline the next steps and to finalize our enrollment pathway. So these initiatives will really change the trajectory of our enrollment, and we're hopeful that our enrollment will bounce back from a full-time, or sorry, from a part-time to a full-time basis into the next year. So any questions?
So I got a couple of quick ones here.
Sure.
So the you pay a fee to the county for the purchasing, correct?
We do.
Yeah. Yep. And is that the same this year as it was previous years?
It is. Yep. Okay. Yeah, we have a contract with the county for that.
Okay. And then the second thing is, you talk a little bit about the tuition increase being part of the budget that is not a permanent thing, right? So mm-hmm. if the state decides that they don't want to make it permanent, then that really would subject, I guess about 20% of the students to, or maybe more than, right, of tuition increases full-time. Right. Yeah.
Right. I mean, we're hopeful that they'll include it in permanent law. They just haven't yet.
Yeah. So now, do you know if there's activity in Albany to actually do that? Are there bills in front of the Assembly and Senate that would do that, or?
They're not yet. So this comes up every year around the budget time. It goes through the budget process, and the executive team has supported it through amendments to the appropriation bill. So it's been included in the governor's appropriation bill, and then the Senate and the Assembly have enacted it. There's been no push to change permanent law at this point.
Yeah. Okay. Just thank
concerning.
You.
We'll continue to keep advocating for that. We want to see that in that permanent law.
We can bug them too, right?
Yeah.
We can if we want to partner, we can, certainly do some memorializing resolutions to the Senate and the Assembly and the governor and ask them to make it permanent if it
benefits great.
The community college,
Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman.
Hold on a minute. Okay, I can't see everybody right now. Fawn, would you mind fixing the screen so the presentation is off for now so I can see everyone? Because I see Joe Maloney has his hand up, but that's all I can see. Okay.
And so, Herb has a question, but you're not going to see me.
Okay, so I'll do in order of my seeing them would be Joe, Herb, and then Chair Barthels.
Yeah, I thought I remembered it being mentioned from last year about some serious investment in classroom technology. It was mentioned, I believe, in last year's, the capital expenditures of last year's budget. I think the presentation, I might be wrong, but I don't think so. Did any of that come to fruition? Where was that?
Absolutely. So we've done overall of Hardenburg. So Hardenburg classrooms are completely equipped for high flex classroom space. We also use a vast majority of our federal stimulus funds to improve the classroom operation. So adding projectors, adding dual monitors for the faculty members so they can do the Zoom and they can do the hybrid. We've also done a reverse hybrid model in some of our classrooms up at the Kingston Center to allow for a faculty member to potentially be in the classroom while other students Zoom in either from Stone Ridge or from home. So we've done a lot of that work. We've completed Hardenburg. Our next up spot will be Vanderlyn. And we're going to continue to use some of the federal stimulus funds. Again, we're really restricted in our use of federal stimulus funds, and we're really focusing on those targeted classroom improvements to enable that social distancing component while we do that remote classroom work.
Mr. Chairman, you're muted, but I'm just going to interrupt.
Sorry, everyone. Thank you. All right, Legislator Litz is next, then we do Chair Bartels and Legislator Erner.
Okay, thank you. I may have missed it because my audio is not that good, but what is the net increase in the tuition to the student over last year?
It'll be $200 a year on a full-time student, and it'll be $10 per credit on a part-time student. So $100 per semester full-time. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, I see a caller at 646-522-8558. May I get your name, caller?
Yes, it's Jen Zell.
Oh, hey, Jen.
Hi, Vaughn.
Chair Bartels?
Thank you. And thank you for the presentation, Jamie. I have a couple very specific questions. Can I ask you just in terms of the budget? On page 13 of the budget, it's academic affairs. I noticed some significant increases, and I just wanted to ask that you explain them. Provision for personnel doubled. Internet allowance went from 1,000 to 40,000. And then there's a chair coordinator pay. Can we start with
absolutely. The Yep. So I'll start with the provision for personnel. So we recently negotiated our contract with our faculty association. That contract was long waited, and we have to do a spread of each faculty member's individual salary. That is the amount that's budgeted right now. It's a placeholder right there. And then we will allocate that to each department based on the faculty members within that department. The new contract did include a longevity component. So we have to go back through all of our faculty records to determine the exact longevity amount for the faculty members. So we put a placeholder in for that point, and then we will spread that as we get closer with working out each individual faculty member's salary amount and longevity amount with the union.
Okay, and the internet allowance?
So the internet allowance is another area that gets spread across all of the faculty members. Faculty members who are teaching in a remote or a hybrid class are eligible to receive an internet allowance pursuant to their contract. We have to determine that amount per faculty member based on the upcoming schedule. So once the schedule is finalized, that amount will be finalized and again will be distributed amongst the departments.
Okay, thank you. And if I may, I had another question. You know, I noticed within certain departments, and I could pull them up, definitely English and foreign language and business and professional studies, that the amount of the budget lines for full-time employees seemed to be significantly down.
Yes.
Can you speak to that across the whole SUNY Ulster? Are we seeing less full-time employees and more part-time employees, or is that just an anomaly in the couple pages? What's happening?
So those departments you mentioned had significant retirements through the retirement incentive. So those senior faculty members, especially in English, did take the retirement incentive. We will be backfilling some of those positions, but we won't be backfilling all of those positions. It'll be based on enrollment. We are seeing a shift in some of the coursework that's going to be offered in the upcoming year based on that full-time to part-time enrollment. We need to really track to make sure that we have a 30-credit load for our faculty members going in on a full-time basis. So those departments, Tracy, that you specifically mentioned are areas that we had large retirements. So those departments had a higher level of, employees and faculty members who decided to take advantage of the retirement incentive.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Legislator Erner, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Cahill. And thank you, Vice President Capuano, for your presentation.
Absolutely.
Can you please explain more your concerns about the drop in enrollment and the increase in part-time enrollment?
Absolutely. So as we continue to track our enrollment numbers, SUNY we're all seeing a decline in enrollment. It's a product of the pandemic. We're hopeful that students will start to emerge and come back to in-person classes. We did notice that early in the pandemic, students were enrolling, but we weren't retaining the students. They were dropping off. They didn't like the remote classroom. We tend to deal with a lot of adult learners, a lot of students who are coming back to the classroom who maybe didn't have a great first attempt. Those students are shifting into that part-time capacity. as students shift more and more into that part-time capacity, our department offices are spread thinner and thinner. They're dealing with more on a headcount basis than they are on an FTE or full-time enrollment basis. So that shift is really impacting the offices that are student-focused offices. They're trying to spend more time with the students who may have additional needs that we can or cannot meet. And we're looking at our staffing levels, trying to maintain their work-life balance at the same time while ensuring that our students' questions are always answered, even through the night. So we're really laser focused on increasing that enrollment number, getting back out there, letting students know that we're back in person. We feel that the students typically who come to SUNY Ulster really need that in-person environment. They struggle particularly with math, they struggle with English. They really need that connection with their faculty member, their tutors, and their support mechanisms that SUNY Ulster has always been for them. And that's where we really need to get the enrollment numbers back and get the students to know that we're here for them and we're gonna continue to serve them. But as we continue to see that shift in part-time, our main concern becomes the staffing levels and how we can continue to support the students in the same manner that we always have.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman, you're
Anybody
muted.
Anybody have any questions or comments? Sorry, I got it on me. It's been a rough week.
Can I ask one more question?
Of course you can. Thank you.
Thank you. Jamie, what, and you may not have the answer right now, this is less a budget question, but what programs are the most successful in terms of enrollment? What programs are you seeing, at least a status quo or rising enrollment in?
So really those are our programs that students are graduating going right into the workforce. So that's your police basic training, your veterinarian technology program, and your nursing program. Those are the programs that really are our banner programs where students are enrolling, they're getting their credentialing, and then they're moving on to a career immediately. Also, the area of micro-credentials has been an area that we're really laser focused on and increasing student engagement and enrollment there. That is another platform where we work with our community leaders and our workforce area to really say students who are working, who need a credential, we can create that program for the employer and for the student to give them the credentialing that they need. This is another big initiative by SUNY, and we're really hopeful that that part-time TAP expansion into workforce will really create another pathway for students to be able to enroll.
Great, thank you. And I just want to say, I attended the graduation, and it's always such a moving event, really, for me. I mean, I was near tears a couple times, actually. You can see that it's a place that's changing lives, and particular to what you just said in terms of people going right on into the workforce. That was evident too in the excitement. So thank you for all you're doing. It's
absolutely,
we're all very, very proud of SUNY New Paltz. I mean, SUNY Ulster.
New Paltz is great too.
Chris, go ahead.
I have a quick question. I'm not sure you're going to have any clue to this answer, but I was just curious if you know if any SUNY Ulster students will be positively affected by Biden's proposed student loan forgiveness.
I can certainly do research on that. I don't have an answer off the top of my head on that one, but I'll certainly dig into that and get back to you.
Sure. Thanks.
Okay. Anyone else Mr. have Chairman? Any comments? Yes. Go ahead, Herb.
Yeah, one additional question. This isn't really budget related, but I guess it could be. I know last year we talked about some deficiencies out in our society and working towards programs, since a lot of our emphasis is on workforce programs to get people back to work and to get retrained. I know there's a huge void in the construction inspection arena. And there was some talk about putting up a course, and I don't, that all of a sudden got dropped. And then just recently, we were having some conversations about the possibility of a meat processing facility in Ulster County, and it's been brought up that there is a need for that type of education because there's not really a lot of trained workforce. Are there anything going on as far as, looking into the possibility of having those types of courses
Well, hopefully this year's curriculum, but probably next year's curriculum.
So I'll absolutely take that one back. In terms of construction inspection, I have not heard of anything right now. That doesn't mean it's not happening on the workforce side. I know our workforce people are very eager and ambitious and tend to have a lot of initiatives in front of them. Definitely on the meat processing, that one is another one we can certainly take back and do a little more research on. We are also seeing a large increase in the number of people taking our wastewater treatment plant or wastewater plant treatment operator. That's a mouthful. That one is we're seeing a large increase in that enrollment as well. I think that's another area in terms of construction inspection that we're, you know, that's definitely something we should be looking at.
Thank you. And if you need any additional information or any help, please give me a call. You have my number.
Absolutely.
I'm actually at a conference. I'm actually at a statewide conference right now. And several of the seminars, it's been brought up that there's an extremely large void in construction inspection, not only in our area, the Hudson Valley, but statewide and nationwide. So there's a lot of discussion on the horizon about how we can correct that.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Herb.
Thank you.
Legislator Hewitt, then Chair Bartels.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the presentation. I was
Absolutely.
Wondering, you mentioned an increase in accessibility needs since mm-hmm. the pandemic. I was wondering if you know if that is related to the pandemic or is a coincidence.
So I do believe it's related to the pandemic. So typically students coming in from high school into college, if they do have an IEP or disability services that they were receiving in the high school level, they do what's called transition planning. That transition planning enables them to come to the college level more prepared and ready to kind of hit the ground running. What we're seeing is during the pandemic, when everything went virtual, those students didn't have that same level of engagement on transition planning. So they're coming to us with maybe higher level of needs in their first or second semester than they typically would had they had a traditional high school experience. That senior year of high school for students with disabilities typically is focused on developing college and career readiness. Absent that really hands-on focus, the students are coming in and maybe it's the same level of services they were receiving in 11th grade. So we're looking at the programming that they were offering, we're looking at their IEPs, and then we're matching that to services that we can provide at the higher ed level. Again, the higher ed level with disability services is different, but not completely unique from the K-12 realm. So we use those IEP services that were provided, and we try to make sure that they can match them. Again, our goal is to create them in a career-ready focus. So we need to be able to be that bridge where we, prior to the pandemic, we were still bridging students into that. They just seemed a little bit more prepared for that bridge when they first came in.
Fascinating. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm going to let Legislator Sperry go first. Is that right, Chair?
Hi, Jamie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you? So I'm not really worried about the drop in enrollment because it's pretty typical of all of the colleges in the area. So, and then the one thing I just wanted to ask about is, you know, you were talking about the numbers of retirees this past cycle. And so I'm wondering as far as, and I know that you were saying that you're kind of responding to lower enrollment, you know, with that. But when you're going to be replacing them or if you've already started replacing those that have retired, will you be replacing them with tenure track people, lecturers or adjuncts or a mix of all? I mean, I'm just curious.
So it's likely going to be a mix of all. So we don't have the lecturer title at the college. We have adjunct instructor, and then we have assistant, associate, and professor levels. We are replacing some of the positions with tenure track positions. Those are the positions that likely will have an increase in the enrollment. English is an area that every student goes through the English department. That's an area where we have to have very strong faculty members, and we're going to be doing a developmental English position. So somebody's going to come in and is going to have that developmental lens while they're teaching English to help our students really succeed. That one will be a tenure track position. Some of the other positions will be filled through adjuncts. Again, that's going to be a bridge to get us through next year. If we do see that enrollment numbers are increasing, we will likely advance those even to potential tenure track positions.
Okay. And who does the advising? Do you guys have an advising office or is it left up to the
We do. So we have both. So we have advising through our academic affairs area with our recruitment team, and we also do have faculty advisors. So they really work together in tandem advising our students. We also have what's called a TRIO program, and our TRIO program, our specific eligible students go through our TRIO program, and that's a really hands-on advising program where they really work one-on-one with their TRIO advisor, and in addition to their faculty advisor and their partner advisor. So we really do have a whole host of advising services available for our students. And that's one area that through the pandemic, we really felt students needed that one-on-one, especially students who really relied on that advising component.
Yeah, I mean, I teach at SUNY New Paltz, and like during the pandemic, my advisees were pretty high maintenance. Like
yeah.
In the past where, you know, I might've had like 2 points of contact with them throughout the semester, I was now having like 6 points of contact. Mm-hmm. You know, with about 35 advisees. So that like changes the workload like tremendously.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yep.
Chair Bartels.
Thank you. I just had a question about the nursing program. I know that there had been discussion about moving it to a 4-year program. Did that happen or do we now have a 4-year nursing program or are we?
We need SUNY approval for anything that's going to be a 4-year program. So we try to work really closely with those who have the 4-year program and work to get our students who are going for the full BSN to transfer out. We would need SUNY approval to do a 4-year program. We're very supportive of having a 4-year program in nursing and would love any support that can be provided to get that pushed.
So what do you need? I think
we need state legislative authority to operate a 4-year program.
Right. But I mean, from us, I think that we should definitely talk more about this and not necessarily at this meeting, but to whatever extent when we talk about a memorializing resolution from the legislature and lobbying on behalf of SUNY. But I would want to make sure that we were very coordinated in our efforts. It could be really a game changer because I personally know people that have chosen, that would have loved to have gone, but chose other schools just because they knew they were going for the 4-year program and figured they would start where they were going to finish.
Right.
And I think you'd see a large uptick in enrollment in what's already a great program. So
absolutely.
Maybe in the coming weeks, we could talk about it more and we can work on a memorializing resolution, but also coordinate lobbying at the state level.
Absolutely. That'd be fantastic.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and anyone else have any comments or questions for Vice President Capiano? All right, well, thank you very much for your presentation and thank you for answering all the questions that we presented. And we will see you on July 19th at the college.
Absolutely, thank you everybody. Be well.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Okay, with that, we'll move on to resolutions. And I just want to remind Herb and Joe that if you have to be on camera to vote on resolutions. Just want to remind you guys of that. So we're going to jump right into resolution 356, which is setting a public hearing on the sale and or transfer of lands owned by Ulster County located at 60 to 64 Boyce's Lane, Town of Ulster, to be held on July 19th, 2022. I just want to reiterate that we're going to be discussing the public hearing only, not the merits of the sale, not any of the particulars of the sale, but the public hearing. And with that, I would like to propose an amendment to that resolution that specifies in the first whereas in the last paragraph that instead of saying building to a local development corporation, that we specify UCEDA in there, Ulster County Economic Development Association. Can I get a second?
Mr. Chairman, first you have to move it for discussion and then you can.
I'll move it for discussion.
And I'll second it.
Okay.
And then before we do, could I just ask the chair a question?
Sure.
just about not discussing the merits because it's a public hearing. I've always heard that as a point made if somebody wants it to go to public hearing, but it's almost sounding like a rule or some kind of like, is that Robert's Rules of Order that we can't discuss the merits of something before sending it to a public hearing? Because many times we've not sent things to a public hearing because we discussed the merits and thought it should go back and get some work before we even put it to the public.
Yeah.
So I was just confused why we wouldn't be discussing the merits and ruling it out.
Let me put it this way. You know, I don't think that it serves any of us very well to get in a long, drawn out conversation about this. There's 6 weeks between now, 7 weeks, 5 weeks between now and the actual public hearing, right? So we have plenty of time for the public to get information. This is notifying the public, and the public can go out and get as much information about this as they want in that time. And in my opinion, that's plenty of time.
We may not want to ultimately do it this way, and then we wouldn't be sending it to the public. This is just unlike anything I've ever heard discussed in a public hearing that discussing the voting to send something to the public and not discussing the merits of it seems odd to me. And are you saying we're not going to be allowed to ask questions about this before sending it to a public hearing?
So again, you know, obviously we're not going to shut anybody down who has a specific question. But I do really think that, we're talking about a public hearing here, and there's ample time for anybody in the legislature. And by the way, the entire legislature was invited to this meeting again, and it will be duly publicly noted what this is all about. Right. And, just to give a brief background on it, right, since it's moved for discussion. So this is a piece of the parcel that was discussed in the previous sale last year that was not ready, not eligible for foreclosure at the time. It has since become eligible for foreclosure, and the county has proceeded with foreclosure proceedings on it. It's crucial. It's absolutely crucial to the overall development of that site because it houses the power plant and the water, I believe, right? The powerhouse and has water connections through it. So without those things, that site value plummets. There's just no way that they could do this without having to rebuild the entire infrastructure to the site. And so it was always, when we did this last year, prior to you being on the legislature this time, Legislator Maloney, was that we did discuss this in detail at that time, that this was going to come forward sometime this year, that this parcel would come up for sale. And when it does, for foreclosure. And when it does, we were going to include it in there. So there has been ample discussion about this parcel coming up. It just hasn't been now, right?
Discussion might not be another legislator's.
To identify the local development corporation as USITA.
So that amendment's been moved. Did we have a second?
Yeah, I don't know.
Just Robert's Rules of Order. I don't think we've actually voted on the motion to discuss this resolution. So I think we have to do that first, don't we? Or no, do we do this?
No, we did. We had a first and a second to discuss.
Okay, I didn't hear.
All those in favor of discussing it? Okay, you're right.
Yeah, you don't vote on whether
we don't need to vote on it.
Yeah, on the discussion. Sorry.
Okay.
Actually, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
The original motion for discussion, you made a motion for an amendment that was never voted on.
Right, and
that's where we're at.
That's right. Yeah.
So we just got the second for the amendment.
Okay. All those in favor of the amendment, please signify by raising your hand. Saying aye. Opposed? And abstained? Anyone? Again, Herb, I'm going to remind you that if you're not on camera, we can't record your vote.
I would love to be on camera, Mr. Chairman, but I'm on the phone because this particular hotel does not have Wi-Fi.
Okay, I'm sorry. I apologize for that.
No problem.
Just to be clear, that amendment was 7-0? Well, Joe, you voted for the amendment too, right?
Yes.
Okay. So
actually, it's 6-0 because I'm not visually.
Tracy makes 7, I think, right?
But Chairman Bartels is with us, so she counts.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Okay. So now let's discuss it a little bit with that amendment. If anybody has any questions, any further questions, and we can, we have Deputy Executive Kelly here. We have Director of Economic Development, Tim Wiedemann here. We can probably get to the nuts and bolts of this very quickly. Legislator Maloney, go ahead.
When you say it's now foreclosable, it wasn't before, is that just because it's hit the 36-month mark of not paying their tax? Why was it not? I was just wondering why it wasn't foreclosable before. That's
yes, okay. That's the reason. Yep.
Do we know if there's, I know the there was a solar firm over there and there's some lawsuits. Some of it was, I believe, against Mr. Ginsburg's remaining property at one point. Is this part of that lawsuit?
I don't believe that there was actually a lawsuit. There was a foreclosure proceeding. And during that time, there was a period at which any claimant against Mr. Ginsburg's property could step forward. I know that at our public hearing back in December, there was some discussion from a claimant. As far as I'm aware, they didn't pursue any legal steps to make a claim against the property.
Okay. And do we have, is there discussions with the price or the do we have an agreed upon value?
If I might, Mr. Chair, is it okay sure, if I respond? We do not. It's not anticipated to have until we come to a purchase and sale agreement. Remember, the sequence here is starting with this resolution, a public hearing before any transfer of the parcel can take place. Then we would come back with a resolution to transfer the parcel. And then once the parcel is transferred, we would conduct all the due diligence and enter into a purchase and sale agreement. And in that, a part of that process would be appraisal and negotiation on price.
And Tim, okay. if everything worked perfectly right now, we're looking still probably till the beginning and sometime next year, right? To close on this parcel?
It's theoretically possible it could happen in the fourth quarter of this year. That's kind of the target. It would require all of the steps that I just listed. And then also an additional 90-day notice period as we learned from the transaction late last year. And then we're also starting to go through for the West Campus now.
Okay. Yeah. Why wouldn't we do an appraisal now and get an evaluation, collect comps and trying to come up with a value to the property? It always seems like sometimes it's even after negotiations. Have we started to negotiate? I'm assuming this is going to Natural Resource or Cotter. We plan on it going to him. So why wouldn't we have some idea of what it's worth now, independent from the person? How do we know? I hear talk that it's pretty much going to Cotter. How do we know that they're going to like the evaluation that we end up having if it truly is independent? It seems like we know where this is all going and it's all going to happen a certain way. I just don't know how we know that.
I'm trying to understand the question.
Okay. Why not? We're planning on transferring this property to the same person that we transferred the last property to, correct?
I think just to be clear about it,
is there a chance that it's going to someone else?
I think that that's not a foregone conclusion. I think that the intent as outlined in the December purchase and sale agreement for the east side, the other parcels on the east side, it was memorialized in that purchase and sale agreement that the intent was to eventually transfer this parcel over to Natural Resources. So that's expressly mentioned in the UCEDA purchase and sale agreement. But just to be clear, there's nothing about a transfer from the county to UCEDA that necessitates that final outcome. But
except you are that correct. UCEDA has already said they plan on giving it. So that sounds like a foregone conclusion to me.
Fair enough. But again, we're at the public hearing. So just to be clear, that decision has not been made yet. So.
Okay. One more quick question. Did Dan A. House going to have anything to do? I know he had a lot to do with the according to Mr. Cotter, he had a lot to do with the negotiations of the last deal that UCEDA made. Is Mr. A. House going to be involved in this deal?
All I can say is that he hasn't been involved with UCEDA or the county. And if Mr. Cotter or his entities...
Cotter publicly stated in front of hundreds of people that he basically accompanied our executive and was one of the main reasons that the deal was made.
I don't recall that was the characterization that Mr. Cotter made.
I have it on video. That's exactly what he said. I know there were other legislators that were surprised as well. They didn't know. Even the supervisor in the town of Ulster was surprised to hear that Mr. A. House was so involved.
Can I just chime in here for a minute, if you don't mind? So, you know, Mr. Cotter can hire whoever he wants as a private businessman to do whatever he wants them to do. But I can tell you that Dan Ahouse never came to the USITA board and never presented anything for National Resources or IPARC 87 to the USITA board ever.
Which is what was so confusing to me and a couple of other legislators hearing that day, especially with all the information I hear about at one point, Mr. Ahouse working for Mr. Ginsburg. So I'm trying to make sure that on behalf of the people that we're getting the best possible deal we can. And when there's conflicts, I think we have to talk about them. Otherwise we're not doing our job. I just want to make sure that.
Yeah. So I just don't think we have the right to stick our nose in Mr. Cotter's business. If he wants to hire Dan Ahouse or the man on the moon, he has a right to do that. And, I don't know what that has to do with setting a public hearing for the transfer of this property or in any way why an employee or a contractor that Mr. Cotter or IPARC hires has anything to do with that. He hires.
I don't know that he did. It sounded like he was almost working on behalf of the county when he accompanied the executive, according to Mr. Cotter. So that's what I'm wondering.
I didn't get that impression. I got that Dan was trying to work. Between people that he knew in government from his time as a congressman and a time working for Maurice Hinchey and trying to connect the dots to help economic development in Ulster County, which I think he did.
So you are very aware of, apparently, Mr. Ahouse was quite involved. And
I don't know that. I don't know that. All I'm saying is that if he was, that would have been why he was, because he does know a lot of people, because he has been involved in government.
Are we sure he wasn't still working for Mr. Ginsburg?
Say that again. Sorry.
Are we sure he wasn't still working for Mr.
I don't know. And I don't know what that has to do with the public hearing for this parcel at this point. So
it's going to be part of it. It's going to be part of the same deal ultimately that was just made. So in my mind, it is part of it.
So this is where I say that we're going to talk about the public hearing. This is where I'm going to draw the line, because we're not going to start throwing people's names around without any kind of evidence that they're doing something nefarious.
And I didn't say it was.
Okay. So I have the floor here, and I'm just going to say that this is what I was talking about when I said we're going to talk about the public hearing, and that's what we're going to talk about.
Thank you, Chair. I'll digress, but I'll just say that. So we don't know. We're told there is no lawsuit pending on the property, and there has not been an appraisal done. It does seem it's a foregone conclusion that's going to Cotter. Those were my main questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone else have any questions or comments? Legislator Bartels, Chair Bartels.
Thanks. And I just want to be clear, because this is something in terms of the issue of appraisals, this is something that's happening with other properties that are being discussed for other projects in the county. And my understanding, and I'm saying this out loud for clarification, is that we cannot sell a property for under a certain percentage of the appraised value. Is that correct? Like that's a county regulation?
This property will be appraised.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Go ahead, Tim.
So I would defer to the county attorney's office to get deep into this matter, but I think the understanding that I have is that the county itself cannot market and sell properties. It can offer them at public auction or it can use them. If it wishes to market and sell properties, it can only do so through a surplus to a local development corporation or equivalent entity. And that entity is not required to sell them at market rate. It can justify a sale below market rate if there's some public benefit in doing so.
Okay. And again, just to clarify, I mean, that this was discussed at the time of the first transfer, both pretty extensively in this committee, given that we knew that there was a key piece of the parcel that was an outlier. And so it's included in the original, the mention of it's included in the original contract, but there was discussion at that time.
Mm-hmm. And if I might add that, the reason that it was so important to include in that contract, even though we weren't in any position to offer it, the foreclosure period had not expired, was due to the very fact that the important infrastructure for the campus is on that parcel. And, so I think just to the point, eventual point of an appraisal, the appraised value of this parcel is intertwined with the appraised values of the other parcels, and the assumptions going in as documented in that December agreement were that this parcel would eventually make its way to the developers to incorporate into the larger campus.
Hey, anyone else have any questions on the public hearing? Legislator Maloney.
I'd just like to make a point to my fellow legislators. As we continue to pass off properties to these public beneficiary corporations, I think we should consider, before passing it off and losing total jurisdiction and oversight over these, where they can then go and basically justify any price they want. The Golden Hill price is beyond alarming. I think we should think about doing our own appraisal before having a true independent appraisal. Just finding out the other day from Mark and Dennis, they haven't even seen the appraisal done by Penrose. Never even saw it. They just went with $1 million evaluation. We have no idea what's even in their appraisal. So that's not due diligence. I think we need to do a better job. I'll be a no on anything like this unless we do an appraisal ourselves. It can be quick. It can be thorough. We can have a number. And then that's a way of us making sure that when we pass this property off and we see the sale down the road, that we did right by the taxpayer. It's just food for thought. And I'd like to do it here, to be honest with you. I think it's a fair request.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else have any comments or questions? Chair Bartels.
Thanks. I'm gonna vote yes for this transfer, considering that we had this discussion and I was definitely a critic about a lot of things related to the Tech City transfer. But this we had an upfront discussion about. But I think Legislator Maloney's raising, when you say food for thought, I think it really is food for thought. I think we should think about, particularly as we transfer multiple properties, I think we should be thinking about the possibility of a policy of appraisals prior to transfer, just so that we can even track what ends up happening. I also accept and understand Director Wiedemann's comment about that there can be a public benefit that's different than a strict selling price. So for me, the fact of an appraisal prior to transfer is more value information. I wouldn't end up saying necessarily on every given property that it would have to go at the exact market. There's a lot of reasons to make transfers in terms of potential public benefit that don't necessarily correlate directly with the appraisal price. But I want to think more about the idea of considering that prior to making those transfers in the future.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Chair. Herb, go ahead.
Okay. This property and all the other properties have been appraised or will be appraised by an independent appraisal firm. If you want to have a third or fourth or fifth appraisal by an independent firm, I don't know why we'd want to do that and expend that county money. Before a transfer takes place or beyond the transfer, they're appraised. The market value is determined, and then they enter in negotiations for the price. So you could have three different appraisals. They could all say the same thing. The only thing we're doing is spending three times the money when who we are hiring are independent appraisers. And that all, the negotiation on the price comes after the appraisal. So you're going to get the market value of the piece of property. And then you go into whether there's a benefit to the county constituents, or the price is this, the price is that, there's contamination on the land, or there's this, or there's that. So I don't know why we have to have more than one independent appraisal. It's just more money spent for no reason.
Thank you, Legislator. Joe, go ahead. And I'm going to
real quick. The problem is we don't know that they're independent. I just heard from everyone, and you mentioned other properties, Mr. Letts, all got their appraisal. No, they didn't. One of the properties that we were told got an appraisal was Golden Hill. They didn't. We didn't see it, and the developer is refusing to show us the appraisal. We went with $1 million evaluation on something that's appraised along with the Golden Hill part at something like $37 million. We went with $1 million appraisal, and that appraisal probably has something to do with demolition, why it was so low, but we're not allowed to see the appraisal. That to me is not an independent appraisal, and it's never going to be independent if we allow the public beneficiary corporation and the developer to do it outside the purview of an oversight and jurisdiction of the county. If we are going to make so much more money with true independent legislative appraisals, because that number is going to be out there, they can then go and choose to use the good of the public. And then they can explain to us when we say, hey, you took less, and it might be good for the public, but it might still be worth the money for the developer to pay for. Golden Hill, the developer up there is eventually going to make a lot of money with all those apartments. So maybe it's good for the public and the developer can pay, but we'll never know what we should have gotten or how that would have went, because we didn't go and get an appraisal. Trust me, if we had a fair appraisal done before Golden Hill goes through, as an example of what we're talking about here, believe me, we would have gotten more than $1 million, what they're talking about at $1 million. And once again, how do we know if we don't control it, hire the firm or firms, how do we know it's independent? How do we know that somebody's not being brought in to put forth a number? How do we know that this new appraisal company that wants future business isn't going to be influenced by the negotiated price, when we go so often in these situations and negotiate the price with these developers, between the public beneficiary corporation and the developers? They're negotiating right now over at Golden Hill, for example, without an appraisal. How do we know that the appraiser comes in and isn't going to look at the negotiated price with regards to their appraisal? It makes sense to get the appraisal done first.
So, legislator Maloney, I think we got your point there. Thank you.
And I just had one more question for Tim, if I could, Brian. Hold on.
There's three other people that want to speak, and I want to give them an opportunity to speak. And then I'd actually like to speak at some point. Legislator Nolan, go ahead.
I'd like to respond. I can't see hands up or anything, but whoever we hire, whether it's an engineer, appraisal firm, they're licensed in New York State. I don't know of any firm that would put their livelihood on the line to fix a number for a developer or anybody else. So the fact of the matter is they are independent, they are hired, they produce a report, they produce an appraisal. They're certified, they're licensed in the state of New York. And I don't understand the whole reasoning behind, well, they're going to hire somebody that will give them the right number, and they'll give whatever number they want, the developer is going to get. Because I don't know of any firm that's licensed in the state of New York that would want to compromise their livelihood and their entire livelihood of all their employees and their company reputation to give somebody a number that is not truly an honest appraisal number.
Then why haven't we seen the Golden Hill appraisal?
Hold on. Legislator Litz has the floor, then it's going to be Legislator Nolan, and then Mr. Wiedemann had his hands up.
I just have a question about
Golden Hill is not the subject of this resolution.
We're moving on from Golden Hill.
You brought up other things.
Legislator Nolan has the floor, please.
Thank you. I agree completely with Legislator Litz. And one of the other points about the timing is that a lot of times these processes do take several years. So you want to have your appraisal done at a time that it's actually going to reflect current market value, not what the market value was several years prior. And I have to leave the meeting for reasons unrelated to this discussion. Thank you, everybody.
Director Wiedemann.
I also have a prior commitment that I'm late to, and I appreciate the committee's deliberations about this. If there's anything further I can answer, I'm happy to do it, but then I do have to jump.
Thank you for sticking around and answering our questions. Appreciate it.
I had one more quick one for him. Just that before you mentioned the past deal with natural resources and this deal kind of being part of that one, were you kind of inferring that part, like that this deal could be less, like some of what they already paid for the monetary value of the first deal, this is kind of included in some way?
I can't speak to, I guess what I am saying is that as we go through the process with this parcel, it's important to recognize that this parcel has important infrastructure that ultimately would cost a substantial amount of money to bypass or redevelop. And so I think there is, you know, an important way in which this parcel is connected to the others. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but that's
kind of what you said before. And I was just wondering if that's what I was kind of hearing was, you were gently telling us that this is pretty much Ertie Cotter's and it was part of the last deal. And that's going to come into effect with what we get for this.
I think what I would say, and you know, it is that the appraisal that was done for the other parts of the campus always assumed that this parcel, as it has all the infrastructure, you know, you don't pay top dollar or even modest dollar for something that doesn't have electricity, doesn't have sewer, doesn't have water. So, you know, there is an underlying assumption that this parcel and the infrastructure on it would be available to the campus. And so if that's not true, then I think it would require revisiting of the appraisals on those other parcels, and that may affect the valuation of those other parcels.
Okay, anyone have any other questions? I'm gonna ask Legislator Criswell to get on screen if he can so we can vote. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. So all those in favor of approving the public hearing for resolution 336, please signify by saying yes.
Aye.
All those opposed? We have one opposed, and Legislator Litz is not on camera and unable to vote. No abstentions. Thank you. We'll move on to the next resolution. And that's resolution 337. And it's approving the execution of a contract for $80,000 entered into by the county for Arts Mid-Hudson Incorporated, the legislature. This is a legislature appropriation. And I believe that they divide that up to other smaller art people. Is that how that works?
A motion for discussion.
Make a motion for discussion. I'm very casual.
That's okay. I'll make a motion for discussion.
Second. Legislator Hewitt. Okay, go ahead.
So they give out several grants. They'll hold, they'll publicize it. Normally they've done all of this already, but they're going to publicize it and give out grants to different artists in Ulster County. They've already done this same thing for Dutchess County this year and other counties. We were just a little late into the game this year.
Right. Legislator Criswell, go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to mention that I actually sat as a panelist, not for this specific grant, but for another grant that they do, which is state funds. And they're very thorough with the way that they vet where these monies go. The grant recipients have to fill out a lengthy grant application. They have to submit all their finances. And then there's a long discussion between panelists about each of them. We rank them according to, you know, which ones seem to have the best impact, which ones seem doable. You know, there are some applications that come where you just don't think the organization is up for it. And so we have that frank discussion. And so I just want to say that I've sat on the grant panel and I really appreciate their process. And so I feel really comfortable giving them money, knowing that they will have a thorough process giving it out to different arts organizations throughout the community.
Any other comments or questions? Legislator Erner.
Thank you, Chair Cahill. Do we know why the disclosure of potential conflicts of interest was not checked on the contract application?
I don't know that answer.
On the contract that's attached, the attorneys tell us which insurances and things they need. So I can ask the attorneys about that.
Chair Bartels.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, to Legislator Erner's question, I'm not exactly sure. And I think the attorneys would be the right one to ask, but I could say that this contract is the standard contract that we approve year over year over year for this funding. So and it's vetted through the attorney's office.
I mean, is it possible that they're not required to do that?
I copied the previous contract. It's also possible that I may have to go back and double check that, you know, they shouldn't provide it. But I know it won't get through the check system if they're supposed to have it. They're very thorough between the insurance office and the attorney's office and the comptroller's office to make sure that we've crossed all of our T's and dotted all of our I's.
Right. Legislator Hewitt?
I think Legislator Sperry was before me.
Oh, I'm sorry, Legislator Sperry. Sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. I'll go after Legislator Hewitt because he knows more about arts and Hudson than I do. I have a question.
I just was going to ask, because my sister received a grant from Arts Mid-Hudson last year and will most likely receive one this year, should I abstain?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I would, you know, defer to the attorney.
I'll ask.
I don't know. Chair Bartels, go ahead.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, and this is not legal advice, but I think that our updated ethics law does not create a conflict for sibling, but to be safe, I would recommend that you abstain right now and then in the interim speak to counsel prior to session day.
Right.
Yeah.
Legislator Sperry, I'm sure you weren't going to talk about that.
No. So is this is the New York State decentralization arts money? So it comes from the state, it goes to the counties, and then
this is just the opposite. I'm sorry, I jumped in. Nope. Chair. That's actually the grant panel that I sat on, was the decentralization. This is actually direct funds from the county that are granted out through Arts Mid-Hudson.
So with the decentralization, the money comes from the pool and the state goes to the counties, and then the counties basically, our counties basically funnel that through Arts Mid-Hudson?
No, totally different pots of money.
Yeah, it's independent of the county altogether, I believe, right?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So that, okay.
Yeah. So they're the second source of funding for these same groups possibly, but it is definitely not something that the county is involved in.
Organizations cannot apply for the decentralization grant and this Ulster County grant at the same time.
And there we go. And that's why Peter's on this committee. Thank you. Any other questions or comments about Resolution 337? Okay. All those in favor? Aye.
And Mr. Maloney, we can't see you.
Opposed.
Okay.
And I'll remind Legislator Maloney. Okay. All those in favor? Aye. We have Maloney back. Okay. And opposed. Okay. Thank you.
Chair, if I could just say, I just went and got some information. This is that last thing we just voted on. I starting in 2011, there was a lawsuit, and there's been a lien that was actually filed in 2019 with Ulster County. I think Brian Rounds might be the judge on that. The original filing goes all the way up, and it's for the power plant property. So there is a lien. I believe it's that solar company that is suing Mr. Ginsburg for the $2 million that he didn't get. I think we have to reconsider doing anything until we find out if there's a lien against this property and somebody may be able to win this property in a lawsuit for Mr. Ginsburg.
Yeah, so I think that we'll leave that to the county attorneys to hash through that part of it. I don't think that at this point, something in a legal proceeding, and my understanding is— We voted on that already, first of all, and it's passed.
But we were just told maybe false information. Or maybe he didn't have that information. I'd be surprised if he didn't. But
so the director of economic development is giving us false information, but
maybe not on purpose. Okay. But Brian, if it turns out there's a lien and this is part of a lawsuit, and I asked the question, then how are we moving forward to transfer this property?
All right. So we have 6 weeks for you to flush that out and bring it up at the public hearing, I think, or have someone do it on your behalf.
Me. It's our job as the legislature.
I'm just saying that you're bringing it up. I don't hear anyone else saying, oh, that's a great idea. And if you think it's a good idea, then go ahead. The committee voted on it. And I'm going to just say at this point, we're going to move on to the next resolution. We've already voted on it. Chair Bartels.
Thanks. I mean, given that we have the 6 weeks, I mean, I do think we need to get an answer to that. Absolutely. But it is a public hearing. We're not doing the transfer yet. So that's something I want to get answers on between now and then. And I will follow up on that, Legislator Maloney, without a doubt.
Okay, so we're moving on to resolution 338, which is approving the execution of a contract for $25,000 entered into by the county for UPAC LLC. And it's a legislative a grant, I guess, is what we'll call that. I'll accept a motion for discussion.
I'll move that.
A second?
Second. Fawn, did you have me down as an abstention on the last resolution? Thank you.
So any discussion on this UPAC resolution giving them $25,000?
Chairman, is this the money that was already in the budget?
I'm going to look.
Yes, sir.
Yes, yeah. Please.
Yeah, so it's from the, yeah, it's, so it was the one that we put in the last budget. We're just appropriating it now.
Okay, good. I just wanted to make sure it wasn't, you know, additional funding above and beyond what we budgeted for.
Right. Okay, any discussion? Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. With that, is there any old business that we need to bring up tonight? Okay, I see none. Any new business that we have to bring up tonight? And with that, from long distance.
I'll make a motion for adjournment.
One second, Legislator Litz. Legislator Erner raised his hand, so we're going to recognize him.
Thank you. I just want to mention to the committee that I had started to put together some information about farm shares, as the Chair Bartels had mentioned in her floor speech a couple sessions ago, and I look forward to talking more about agriculture with the committee in the meetings to come.
Thank you. That's great.
Thank you. Anything else? Legislator Hewitt?
I just want to thank Legislator Erner for bringing that up. I think that Amanda LaValle's presentation was good, but it needs a lot of work, because right now I think it is a plan to give out fish and we need to teach people to fish. Right. So I'm looking forward to actually making progress in this committee, because ARPA is a one-time shot. This is a long-term discussion.
Right. I agree. Anyone else have anything? Okay, Herb, you're up.
Well, I can make a motion for adjournment. I just can't vote on it.
I'll make a motion to adjourn.
All right. Okay. Second. Okay. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
And I want to note that Legislator Maloney has left the meeting prior to this last vote here. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Have a great night. Take care. Bye. Bye-bye.